is I studied your catalog and what your course had promised you, and it was very specific in its promises, so I thought I would cover absolutely everything in the catalog there. is the experience of being alive in America is one of them. But then it says, it's promised that I will cover social criticism, and I do criticize society because I'm very uncomfortable in it. It's politics, is I am a Unitarian. About identity. It mentions the problem of the author and identity, which is a very interesting subject, which people don't understand, is that the author's life is a quest, and so is everybody else's. But the author's life is a more overt quest. See, and he doesn't know what he's going to find. And he promises to find things. And I can remember when Salinger was publishing serially in the New Yorker, people were saying, where is he going? And they would try to find him and say, you know, where are you going? What are you going to find? We'd like to know. Well, he didn't know. And he finally came back essentially to his first story, I guess, is the banana fish story. But he made a full circle. But that's a quest, because a knight doesn't know where he's going unless the whole thing is rigged in the first place. I've done an irresponsible critical piece on the entire works of Hermann Hesse for Horizon magazine based on an actual reading of 5 of his books. And he did. The reason he is so popular now among the young is he does find stuff at the end of every book. He finds of the 5 I read is there was always something to find, which is touching, you know, because it's a lie. There's nothing to find. And he's pandering to people, really, to say there's anything to find. And I admire tremendously the Nobel Prize having gone to Samuel Beckett, who said there's nothing to find. Because there isn't, you know, that's the truth. About race is I am white, and I've been in the publishing business one way or another for 20 years, so all my friends are Jews, every one of them. Is the city, I don't live in one. I live on Cape Cod. About war, these are things that are listed in your catalog. That's why they... I like the war, and one thing that is very seldom said was that the infantry feels good. It really does. It just feels awfully good for a while. And I liked it, and in one of my books I said, man is an infantry animal, and he is. And one thing about war is, you know, you get so excited because there's so much noise and everything, it doesn't hurt for a while if you get hit, you know. It's just like you're part of a movie that was made, you know, it's all right. Don't worry about it. If you have to go to war, if you jump up and down, see, if you get to run around and there's a lot of noise, if somebody just snipes you, that will hurt, you know, if it's just quiet. But anyway, generally, war doesn't hurt. It just looks like it ought to. About the American dream, it has come true for me, is I made $71,000 this year, and that... And as I understand it, that is the American dream, I think. And if that wasn't, there's a little dab of whipped cream on top, which is, I am to be the commencement speaker at Bennington College. All right, the experience of being alive in America. A lot of people think I speak English awfully good for somebody who was born in Germany. People frequently comment on how good my English is. Well, my great-grandfather was born in the United States, and we're as patriotic as anybody. God damn it, we've been over over here helping to build it in your own country. And is that the places I have been alive in America are Indianapolis, Indiana, Chicago, Illinois, Schenectady, New York, and Cape Cod, and Iowa City, Iowa. And Norman Mailer seems like a regional writer to me. I have never... Interestingly enough, Joseph Heller does not, and neither does Philip Roth. I left Indianapolis following puberty. Is my father and grandfather were both architects out there. Is when I went into the arts, it was a perfectly ordinary thing to do. It wasn't parent bopping. You know, it often is a terrible insult to some family if one of the kids turns out to be an artist, you know. And that's one way to really shake up a family if you haven't got nerve enough to turn into a homosexual. As my father and my grandfather were not only architects, but they were painters in Indianapolis, and they were pretty good. But they were extremely uncomfortable out there because there is a strong feeling in the Middle West that the artist is not pulling his own weight, no matter how hard he may work, is that the other people are doing the real stuff. And, you know, when the men out there at parties get together to talk to the men, well, you find the architect talking to the women, which isn't too bad, really, when you think about it. It's all right. But you take a city like Kansas City, which has, I hope some of you have seen it, it's one of the beautiful cities of the world. They've had excellent architects there, and it is lovely. There's not one author out there, not one. That's Kansas City is 10 times the size of Athens, of ancient Athens. Muncie, Indiana is 1.5 times as big as ancient Athens. Is it something is being done to discourage the arts out there? Anyway, nobody stays. When I went to high school in Indianapolis, I learned how to walk around looking tough. Because everybody had to do that, and I went out to Indianapolis, or I go out there occasionally, and they're still doing it. It's walking around looking very tough. Because something might happen, you know? And I'm an old guy now, and so part of my life was before the Great Depression, and during the part before the Great Depression, I was raised by a black maid by the name of Ida Young. And I probably talked to her more than anybody. So whatever is nutty about me was nutty about her too, I think, because I saw a lot more of her than I did of my parents. Now here comes a rather intimate part, and I'm not kidding, it's intimate, as I used to keep it a big secret, and I used to have awful guilt feelings whenever my six publishers' copies of a new book came. I couldn't open the damn thing, and I'd try to figure out without the help of experts is why I felt so sick about this. And I think I figured it out because the message I was getting was, you told in that book. Well, the awful secret is that my mother was crazy toward the end, and we kept this a secret. She was all right. During the daytime, she's dead now, see, and I finally figured out the dead people don't care what you say about them, it's okay. And also, I'm her son, you know, so she wouldn't knock me. But anyway, she was all right in the daytime unless you tried to take her picture, where you get a bizarre reaction. At night, she would really get wild, squaring people away and crashing around the house. And that was barbiturates, as... These were supposed to tranquilize her, and it turned her brain to cobwebs. My father said one time, you never used a villain in a story. And other people have commented that I don't belong with the black humorist because I'm not a mother bopper, and I'm not a father bopper either. And there's a reason with this, is I can't get mad at my mother because I pity her so much is what she went through. And, you know, if she'd stayed sane, she might have got it too, as a lot of other mothers have. I doubt it, though. She was smarter than the other mothers I read about in other guys' bestsellers. Anyway, I have a reputation for writing compassionate books, and out at the University of Iowa, I taught a course about how the trick is really done, because people will treat Chekhov's compassion, for instance, as a spiritual matter, as something invisible. Well, that's scientifically impossible. There's no telepathy as possible with a book. It's little marks on the page, and they have to be put down there in a certain order. So you can study books to see how effects are achieved, is how the lady is actually sawed in half. The way Chekhov works is, before you know what the story is about, he will have a person who is going to behave badly. You don't know this person's going to behave badly. Do something very kind. Touch a child in a tender way. Pet a dog. Speak nicely to an underling. And then the thing goes, and you read the whole goddamn story, and some part of your mind remembers what this person who is going to behave badly later on did. And because of this sort of cunning, which is not calculated, which is intuitive, you can't write that carefully. But this is how Chekhov, in his short stories, has a reputation for compassion. There's no story without a kind gesture somewhere. So if you want to be popular, you might callously do that. Somebody asked me how I achieved the effect of being compassionate and yet dealing with horrible matters. And I had to think about that, and then I realized that this is the technique used in Candide. As you can write perfectly heartlessly and on the surface as Candide is written. But what makes Candide compassionate, and what makes my books compassionate too, is what the books choose to look at, is obviously the selection of incidents is pitiful and is a selection that only could be made by a compassionate person, even though there is this raw, court vile surface on the thing. Okay. I went and saw my parents' tombstones out in Crown Hill Cemetery out in Indianapolis a couple of months ago, and I cried, and I hadn't cried for a long time, and what I was crying about was I wished they had been happier than they were. And I think this is probably a dumb thing to do. I think probably parents are much happier than the parents realize. I remember I asked my father what the happiest day of his marriage had been. This was after my mother died. And he said, well, they had an Oldsmobile, a little Oldsmobile. This was before the First World War, probably. And they broke into the Indianapolis 500-mile speedway one Sunday and just drove around and around and around and around. That's pretty good. Is my latest book is about something that actually happened to me. It's a very bad idea for men to write about things that actually happened to them. Is in the field of writing, I don't think there will ever actually be unisex, and I don't know why this is, but one sex difference, which isn't a cultural difference, I don't believe, is that women can write about things that have upset them a great deal, and recently, and that men cannot, or men are ill-advised to write about the relationships, their real relationship with their bastard father, for instance. It's going to be very junky and clotted. That if you teach writing at writers' workshops and summer camps for writers and stuff, there are hundreds of divorcees there, which is, you know, sort of a fringe benefit for the faculty. There are all these women whose marriages have just busted up, and by God, they can sit down and write about what really happened, and they can rack themselves up too. They know exactly what went wrong. That just happened a couple of weeks ago, and you would think it would tear him up. It would tear a man up. He could not do it. He couldn't do it for 5, 10 years. Okay, what men do and what everybody is well advised to do is to not write about your own life. This is if you want to write fast. you will be writing about your own life anyway, but you won't know it is if you write a hack Western like, or not a hack Western, if you write an excellent Western like High Noon, is somewhere in there is coded a psychiatric problem of the author. And if you write an episode for some space program on television, is this will somehow parallel things that are on your mind, is unresolved conflict. But that's the place to write, and that's the way to deal with your conflicts too. If you want to write fast, if you don't want to get blocked. Slaughterhouse 5 was about the only thing I ever wrote about something that really happened to me. It was a nauseating experience, and I'm trying again now to write about something that really happened to me. It's about having, incidentally, among other things, a mother who wrecked her mind with barbiturates and roamed the house at night and couldn't have her picture taken in the daytime, otherwise she was all right. Well, this is making me sick too, see, but I feel, oh hell, do it anyway. But a young writer, it would be miserable advice to him to, write about something you know about. There's one guy out at the University of Iowa, there was one guy from New York named Jerry Seiss, who has since become a radical leader out there, and he's wrecked that nice Middle Western college. He came here from the big city and just crapped it all up. And anyway, he was a student of mine, and he had writer's block. And so I told him to write A Man and a Woman. It was just playing in town. I told him to go see it and write it. And he did. And he wrote a neat road racing story. You know, he just took his teacher's advice. It was a very good story. Okay. But he went bad. He went political, which is... artists aren't supposed to be political. Okay. They got enough to do anyway. Okay. What have I got here? Oh, yeah, about writers... I sort of feel like stopping now. It's not speaking, but writing. It's interesting about when writers feel like stopping. It's, yeah, hell, I don't give a damn if another book by me ever comes out. And a good friend out at Iowa was Vance Bourgeli. And I asked him about it. He and I are about the same age. And he said, yeah, he thought he could quit now and not feel too bad about it. He could quit. There wasn't that inner necessity anymore to write. But he also said he could. And Nelson Algren was out there at the same time teaching, and Nelson said at that time, and he may have changed his mind now, that he didn't think he had another book in him. And Vance Bourgeli said, hell, I've always got another book in me. You know, I can always think of one, but maybe I just won't write it. But he was upset that Nelson said there wasn't anything more inside of him. There is a lot more inside of Nelson, I guess, because he's published considerable since then. I've heard that a writer is lucky because he cures himself every day with his work. And that's right, except that I cured myself, not that the book was important to anybody else, but the last book, Slaughterhouse 5, was important to me for some reason, which remains uncoded. I'm turned off now. I'm not strongly motivated to write another book. Another crazy thing happened. I changed from right-handed to left-handed. And I called my brother about this, and I said, Jesus, I never heard this about, you know, maybe I was left-handed, and he's 10 years older than I am. He said, yeah, you were ambidextrous. Well, after I finished that book and got $71,000, I turned into a southpaw. As my relatives in Indianapolis don't like the dirty words in my book, and they think I do that because if you put a dirty word in a book, is people will buy a lot more copies because it's so exciting to certain types of people. Is my mother-in-law was with me for the last 2 weeks, and I finally got her to talk about it some, and it was very unpleasant. She had told me this. It brought messages from other relatives that it wasn't necessary to put dirty words in the book. And this poor old lady, she's very nice. I finally pinned her down. She had never said these words in her life, and I finally got her to admit it, to distinguish. And I found out that fuck is all right, maybe, but you should never say shit. And I've been thinking about that ever since. I haven't been completely idle since completing my book, Slaughterhouse-Five. What I did is, and I would like to, there's news being made tonight because I haven't announced this before publicly, and one reason I want to announce it is to establish you, put you in condition to testify that this is actually a first for me, and that you heard about this on November, what is this, the 6th? I think, see, now this story hasn't been published yet, but the story is written and accepted and everything. I think I'm the first person to use the word in a title. I have written a story called The Big Space Fuck. And it's about this big see what it is. It's about the end of the world. Is the and it's about a couple living on the edge of Lake Erie there, and the all they're left are lampreys and human beings, and they're turning into man-eating lampreys, and they. The space program now has built this enormous spaceship, which they're going to send fire at the Andromeda Galaxy, which is 2 million light years away. And the hope is that human life will somewhere go on, because obviously the Earth is exhausted. And the name of this spaceship, which is an enormous thing, is the Arthur C. Clarke. And it's got a big warhead on it filled with sperm, you see. And they are firing this thing out there, hoping it'll hit something, you see. And life. Okay. As I started in this business while I was a public relations man at General Electric. At that time, it was, 1950 as I became a freelance. At that time, there was a Saturday Evening Post, there was Liberty, there was Collier's, and they were all very hungry for stories. And if you could hack out something that looked like a story, you could sell it. Now, this industry no longer exists, which is too bad. Stories were heavily plotted then, and I was often considered writing a brilliant essay, and I understand that T.S. Eliot got credit for writing essays he'd only promised. So I will promise one showing that the popular plot forms in any civilization at any given time parallel exactly the conception of life on Earth and the life afterwards. And when I started writing, why, people still believed in heaven and insisted on happy endings on stories. And they don't insist on this anymore because they know God is dead. And if you read Indian legends, the stories the Indians told each other to amuse each other, the story is just linear, as the people go out to get food and they go over a mountain and they cross a river and they find a deer and they kill the deer. And they go on and on and on, and they're infinitely extensible, and they end anywhere with the words, "That is all." You see? And American stories are getting very much like that. So when I was teaching at the University of Iowa, why most of the stories I got were about love in the English department, because that was all of all of life any of the students had seen. And I remember telling a student, "Hey, why don't you get out of here and get to do what American writers used to do, is get a job on a newspaper?" And he said, "Because I'll get drafted." And I said, "Okay, stay in here, it's all right." And all right, my academic training was, I have no college degree. And such training as I had was basically in chemistry, because my father wanted me to study something practical in college, something that would make me some money. And one advantage of not having taken anything past freshman English was that I did not have to learn good taste. And so that when I was writing badly, I thought it was pretty damn good. If I had been in the English department and had written a story which was pretty good for a guy 19 years old, Professor Sweetbreads would have come over and said, "My boy, that's extremely interesting. Now I want to show you how Henry James handled exactly the same situation." It's, "Thanks a lot, you son of a bitch." You know, and on some level, they know what they're doing, too. There's no English department has ever produced a writer. It's a pretty efficient system. I'm interviewed constantly now, and they ask me what authors have inspired me most. And so I think up some. And then 2 days after the interview, I say, "God damn it, I forgot it again. It's Robert Louis Stevenson." And it's easy one to forget. But he's not a moldy fig. I'm so grateful for stories still, probably because I had a vested interest in them at one time. But Treasure Island is a beautifully made thing, and a charming put on. And Jekyll and Hyde is a splendid conception. It is a very good thinking about life. And that's what writing is about. It always has been sacred, and even if it is, if people don't intend it to be sacred, people who've just been born keep picking up books to find out how the hell you're supposed to live. And the bestsellers, like The Exhibitionist and the Jacqueline Suzanne things, are sacred books too. If you will look in them, you will find lessons on how the hell to act in a French restaurant. Do you tip? How do you get in and out of a gondola in case you ever go to Venice? Is what kind of drapes do movie stars have? What time do movie stars eat dinner? If you're, and so forth, because as people might have to decorate something nice sometime, as their fortunes might change, and these. These are lessons on how to live and are Bibles. There's a guy I always put at the head of my list of authors who've inspired me most is George Orwell. And I would like to be Orwell very much, except for one thing, that he's dead. And he apparently let himself die There's an Orwell scholar here I'd like to hear it denied. It's my impression was that he declined to have his tuberculosis treated in any very effective way. Hemingway turned himself off with a double. I am now older than F. Scott Fitzgerald when he died. I'm older than D.H. Lawrence when he died. I'm older than George Orwell when he died. I'm 47. I'll soon be older than Jack Kerouac when he died. He was a couple of months older than I was. I knew Kerouac slightly. And I've wondered, of course, is why the hell authors die so young and even go to the trouble of turning themselves off. Just it interests me as an actuarial problem, you know, because that's the trade I'm in. As Kerouac said, he busted himself with booze. It's just drank incredible amounts of alcohol till he had a massive hemorrhage and, what, died a couple of weeks ago, a week and a half ago, not very long ago. Anyway, I've wondered why the hell he killed himself and why all these people kill themselves. And one thing is, I think that writers, creative writers, are in the process of becoming. They are humanity becoming. I think they draw on telepathic sources and so forth. But when you teach people who are not wanting to become hacks, but are really trying to get something out of their system, it's like reaching into the mouth of the student and taking hold of a piece of tape in the back of the mouth, student's mouth without getting bitten and seeing what the hell's written on it and then just keep pulling it out. And the person doesn't know what the hell it is. And I think most, and it's a new message that somehow mankind, whatever, has conspired to deliver at this interface in time. And I think it becomes an exhausting thing to do. That's about it. A lot of people decline to do it anymore. It becomes too unpleasant. Just don't worry about me, I'm right. One bad thing is that speed works for writers. Because there never used to be anything that worked for writers that would help writers work better, but speed does for a little while. And most writers are drunks, and this is a... this is a business problem. This is an occupational hazard, is they can't work in the afternoons, most of them. And so they get plastered in order to turn themselves off. If they would legalize marijuana, they would save an awful lot of creative lives, I think. Is maybe our authors would live to be on the average of 52 or something like that. I haven't in my books handled women very well, and there are a couple of reasons for that. I'll give you an official one. Is the minute you talk about sex, you can't talk about anything else. And you might want to talk about some other aspect of life. And if you look in the works of Louis Fanon Celine or Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, you will find that they both didactically at the beginning say, that isn't going to be the solution. It's not going to be a broad that's going to solve my particular angst. Because she can, you know. And the guy wants to tell another story. I came here with a paranoid announcement. I was going to say that I have appeared in the New York Review of Books only once in a paid ad. And then in the introduction I learned that I had been mentioned. I was so pissed off at the thing, I stopped reading it and assumed they never would mention me. I have a friend, David Heyman, who's a critic out at the University of Iowa, and he's a Celine scholar, and he says that you probably can't be an important artist if you are not a paranoid. And there are reasons for this. This is not a joke or anything. He really means it. And the thing is, in order to sit alone and work all day long, you must overreact. You must be a terrible overreactor. And you're sitting there doing what paranoids do, is putting together clues, making them add up, you know. putting the fact that they put me into room 471, you know, and what does that mean and everything? Well, nothing means anything, as I've said, and as Beckett says, except there is this, the artist makes his living by pretending, by putting it in a meaningful hole, though no such holes exist, and it takes a paranoid mind to do this, and you need paranoia for energy, too. You must be terribly worried and secretly full of hate. Frequently when I've spoken to students, or one time I spoke to the Press Association, College Press Association, or some damn thing, and the speech obviously bombed. And I said, what the hell was the matter? And they said, well, we'd gotten you out here to moralize, which is an old-fashioned word. So I moralize every time now, as I didn't really, you know, it's like asking, we had expected you to play the dulcimer or the sackbut. Some obscure medieval thing they'd hoped me to do. But anyway, so I do moralize, and I tell people is don't kill. Don't kill even in self-defense. Don't work on killing machines. Is don't litter, and don't take more than you need. And know you are going to die, and think about it. And the reason I put that in there is that Slaughterhouse-Five is about how badly American prisoners of war behaved in the Second World War and again in the Korean War. As they let each other die, they were filthy, they wouldn't wash. And this was quite startling, as the other prisoners of war all survived much better than the Americans do. And so I reported this in my novel, and I heard from a lot of guys who had been in prison at the same time I was, who had seen this, and one guy said that the people he'd seen who had survived best were fundamentalists, as hillbillies, who, and he supposed this was because they were used to the idea of death at coming to you at any time in a state of rest. And of course that's what prison is you're sitting there waiting. And what many people found demoralizing and finally shattering was that death could come at any time, as without any romance or excitement or anything else. And the fundamentalist knows at any moment he may die and God will take him back to heaven. And this has been told to him, and it isn't told to most of us. So let me tell you, you are going to die. And if you think about it from time to time, I think it would probably... make you braver in jail. As the Turks held up best of anybody in the prison camps in Korea, and they held hands and they hugged each other from time to time. I was thinking about the usefulness of love, and I. My favorite poem, or, you know, the only poem I know, that's why it's a favorite one, is a William Blake thing. The angel that presided o'er my birth said, little creature born of joy and mirth, go love without the help of anything on earth. Go love without the help on anything of earth. There's no reason why you should love, but go do it anyway, see, and don't look for reasons. And that's what you do, too, is writing schools are foolish, is, again, go write without the help of anything on earth. Is how important my books are, or anybody's books are, I don't know. I don't think they're terribly important. I think that they make people contented during the period they're reading them. And this is something. This is worth something, is to take care of somebody for a couple of hours. It was Laurel and Hardy and W.C. Fields, as a word of honor, were the saints in my life as they sustained me thoroughly. And you will find people who are actually comforting millions. It's not within Nixon's power to do this, for instance. But it is within the Beatles' power. And there will always be magic entertainers who will comfort people some during the Job story that all our lives are. And for this reason, I honor my own profession, because we are entertainers, don't do a whole lot, but something. As I'm charmed to see people dressing in order to entertain each other, is to behave in ways, silly ways, to cheer each other up, as people are cheering up strangers by dopey little tricks that really don't take much talent, and life can become much more bearable on that account. And it isn't very hard. Yeah.